One soul or two?
Hello, everyone. It is Tea Time Horror Stories, and we're back for the second episode of the second season. I know in our last episode, we didn't exactly like say what episode it was or anything like that. I hadn't really decided how it was going to, I guess, start us off again, how to put it that way.
Launch?
Yeah, our launch, a new launch. There you go. That's a better way of putting it.
Well, it's also kind of difficult since we're missing one.
Yeah, we're missing one.
Yeah.
Like I said, that's still up for debate. I'm still, you know, Yelly and I talk about it little by little, maybe when she's ever in town or if we're closer to her and we have all her recording stuff with us, we will be able to, you know, record with her again because we do miss her. She's the third person of us. It was the three of us. I'm still working on possibly having special guests come as our third person, kind of just as a react sort of thing.
But it also makes things difficult because we're still in that quarantine.
Yeah, this whole stay in place thing it's pretty extreme. I mean, we've been in it for a little over two months now. Everything's starting to get back to normal, but it just depends on what you think normal is.
Well, if you consider normal traffic as normal, then yeah, things are pretty normal again.
No, traffic is still, it's not as bad, but it's still bad. Anyway, so yeah, welcome everyone. This is Season 2, Episode 2. Last week, we started you guys off with a murder, a family aside to be exact. And as we follow our normal schedule, we are changing it up a bit. This time, we are going to be doing, it is week of paranormal this week.
Paranormal.
It's Joe's week, basically.
Then normal. Actually, it's not necessarily just paranormal. It's kind of a mixture of murder and paranormal.
Yeah, so today we have a special for you guys. We decided to, so we had been planning this episode actually for a really long time since before we went on our break. This is a very unique case. But first, before we jump into the case, Joe, what are you drinking? It's so red.
Well, that's Gatorade. It's watered down Gatorade.
Yeah, the electrolytes help him out. But when I say it's watered down, he puts like a quarter.
It's half and half.
He says it's half and half, but it's not. You would taste more water than you would Gatorade.
It stretches out the Gatorade.
Sure.
But earlier I had a drink from a undisclosed location and it had ginger in it and turmeric and all kinds of other things.
That helps him with his digestive system and his belly, which he's still working on. I right now have a very almost empty cup of a chai tea latte. Is that considered a tea? I think it's a tea.
There's chai tea.
Yeah, it's tea. It has tea in it. See,
it's a tea.
I'm the only one who's following our title right now who has a tea in front of me. Thanks, Joe. But my backup is, again, going back to my Arizona sweet tea.
Yeah, but I can't help it when I drink my drink before we start recording.
Yeah, well, whatever. Excuses. So yeah, let's get back to, now that you guys know, okay, how's your week been, Joe? I don't know, this whole stay in place, you know, we live together, so week is my week.
You still find it necessary to ask me how my week is going?
For anyone who actually listens or cares, we are officially moved into our little hut, our little cabin.
We still got a lot of things to move though.
Yeah, but we are about almost halfway there. We have a couch now, so we're not sitting on the floor. Our whole bed and everything is in here as well. So we're getting pretty comfortable. We've been in here for the past couple days, and we're slowly making it ours. We're making it very personal. With the stay in place, we haven't really been able to do much of anything than just work on this cabin. I mean, you really have to have a reason.
3 months, pretty much?
2.5.
3 months?
It'll be 3 months soon. Anyways, yeah. So it's just been quite normal, nothing really too exciting. So I'm pretty sure you guys are eager to listen to what we have in store for you this week. So this week we are doing a paranormal, but we're doing a tag team. So we had done this once or twice last year.
Yeah, I think it was just once.
I think it was one time and we had just introduced it and we had gotten people who actually really liked it. So we wanted to continue doing this. So this week we are doing a paranormal, but we're also including a murder on top of it because it goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start us off first and then it will lead to Joe who will show you he will tell you guys about the paranormal side. So what are we covering? We're covering Fox Hollow Farm.
Yeah. Fox Hollow Farm in Illinois?
Illinois. Yeah. Yes. So let's get into it, shall we?
Let's.
So I'm going to give you guys the background of this place. The person. Let's
get deep into that hollow.
Really deep. So we're going to jump into it. I'm going to give you guys the background on the place and why it could be haunted. And then he's going to tell you why it is haunted. Welcome to Week of the Paranormal / Myth. Alrighty. Fox Hollow Farm. Also, the person who's involved in Fox Hollow Farm is by the name of Herbert Richard Buettmeister?
It's Baumeister.
There's no L.
Baumeister.
There's no L.
There is no L. It's Baumeister.
Baumeister. Should we get Google on this?
You should probably get Google on it, but I'm pretty sure I'm pronouncing it a little off, but I'm pretty sure it's more Baumeister.
You're right. Baumeister. Well, that's it in German. Okay, so Google comes to my rescue again because I don't know how to pronounce anything. I'm really going to struggle with that last name. I struggle with all names. I'm just horrible at that. So Herbert Richard Baumeister, or a.k.a. Herb, just going to refer to Herb, or as he's been known for some people, is the I-70 Strangler.
Yeah.
Herb was born April 7th, 1947. For all those who really want to know, he's an Aries. He's a fire goat. He was a suspect in, he was a suspected American serial killer. So he owned two Save-A-Lots, which were just thrift stores. But let's get back to what I say suspected. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was never convicted of anything that was against his name.
Yeah. And Sam will get more into that later. I was going to say something, but I'm pretty sure she's got it covered.
We'll find out. Again, when I say suspected, he was never convicted of anything. So Herb is, we're going to just call him Herb. I might refer to him as Little Herbie. I don't know. because we do talk about his dad a little bit. So Herb was under investigation for murdering over a dozen men in the early 1990s, most of whom were seen at gay bars. Police found human remains on his property and issued an arrest warrant. Herbie went on the run. He fled to Canada before anyone could get anything from him. He did commit suicide, so they weren't able to interview him for anything. He never confessed to his crimes. His suicide note, which was 3 pages long, didn't mention anything about any of the allegations, any of the murders, nothing. But he was linked to several murders for at least 9 men along Interstate 90, hence his nickname, I-90 Strangler, which happened in the early to mid-1980s.
Mm-hmm.
Let's find out who Little Herbie is in his early lives, because, you know, we like doing details, just me. So Herb was the eldest of 4 children from Dr. Herb E. That's why I call him Herbie, because his dad's also named Herbert. And so from Dr. Herbert E. and Elizabeth Buettmeister.
Baumeister,
whatever, in Indianapolis. His father was a very successful anesthesiologist. After the youngest was born, the family moved north of Indianapolis to a little town called Washington Township. Everywhere I could find, by all accounts, Herb had a simple and normal childhood. Like, there was nothing abnormal about him until he reached his adolescence.
Kind of sounds like most serial killers.
Kind of, sort of, actually. Like, there were some serial killers out there that started to act funky since they were, like, kids. But he didn't start until, like, puberty hit him. And then that's when his psychopathic side came out, I guess you can say.
What are these hormones inside me?
Basically, so with that
being said, I must kill people.
Well, with that being said, he became completely obsessed with anything macabre. Anything vile or disgusting, it was like he was like a fly on shit with that. He just loved it. He was completely and utterly turned on by it. He developed a rather dark and macabre sense of humor, much like myself, and seemed to have lost all ability to judge from right or wrong. Not like me at all. I can tell you that for sure. Rumor had it, he urinated on his teacher's desk and put a dead crow on his teacher's desk as well.
That's what you get for giving that kid an F.
Well, needless to say, he pretty much freaked everybody out. Everyone kept distancing themselves from him.
So they were practicing
The 6 feet rule, yeah, basically.
With him, like, social since distancing. The beginning. Social distancing with
they
him.
Brought social distancing to the forefront there.
Well, before just that one kid. I guess he was just...
He had
infected with
he had the COVID at the time. They really were very leery and scared of his morbid behavior in class. He was disruptive and volatile. His teachers
volatile.
Yeah, did I say that weird?
Yeah, I thought you said something else like volatile.
Volatile.
Volatile. God damn it! No, I'm saying it wrong.
I can't pronounce words right. I swear I know English. His teacher reached out to his parents, having noticed his changes, and they agreed to get him help. After seeing many doctors, tests and countless evaluations were done on him, he was diagnosed as schizophrenic and suffered from multi-personality disorder. Unfortunately, though, his parents did not seek treatment for him. I mean...
Well, it was also during that time where it was kind of...
Yeah, I was just about to jump into that. This was in the 1960s, and the only really available ECT, which we know as electroconvulsive therapy, and people usually diagnosed with any kind of mental issues, whether it be you have multi-personality, if you're gay or anything, they just thought they could shock it out of you, literally. Back in the day, if you were mentally ill, it just meant a death wish more than anything else. The hospitals were known to shock unruly patients several times a day, not only in hopes of curing them, but just simply to make them manageable for the staff. If it wasn't until the late 1970s, drug therapy mostly replaced ECT, because it was more humane and provided better results. But that just depends.
I was about to ask, would you prefer to be lobotomized or electroshock
therapy? Yeah, because that's what I was just about. That depends on who you ask. Because most of the time, this medication turned people into, like, mindless potatoes. They didn't... Yeah, they just were like, drug them the fuck up so we don't have to deal with them ever.
Just minus the chipping away of your brain.
Yeah, it was basically a lobotomy, but with drugs. Yeah, but that's on a whole different story. But... I do kind of want to cover that one day, but I don't know if, I don't know, maybe that's like a history kind of episode, but I just wanted to cover...
That would be a history episode, actually.
I don't know, maybe it'll be one of my special episodes, but I do want to cover the evolution of mental hospitals from how they started to how they are now. Not that they're perfect, they're probably far from it, or they are far from it, but, you know, just let us know. If that's something you guys want to learn or hear from us, let me know. Send us an email, get us on Instagram, whatever, and we'll work on that. So anyways, let's get back to Herbie. Anyways, there was never any record that Herb got any kind of medical help for his mental disorder. He continued to attend public school and somehow managed to maintain his grades, but completely failed with society. But he tried. He really, honestly did. He tried to fit in with people, but no one really accepted him. He was rejected repeatedly by all popular cliques in high school. In the end, he finished school as a complete loner and in complete solitude. No one wanted to be friends with him. It was pretty sad. I'd actually probably be friends with him. I was one of those people who were friends with all the lonely people. So in 1965, Herbie attended Indiana University, and unfortunately, his attitude and everything kind of followed him. Again, he was an outcast because of his strange and odd behavior. He didn't last long, dropping out of UE in the first semester. His dad didn't agree with him, so he pushed him to go back, but he did, returning in 1967 to study anatomy, but once more dropped out again before the semester was over. But something did good come out of this. He actually met someone. Yep. He met a high school journalist teacher and part-time IU student, Juliana, or Julia as I'll refer to her, Satire?
I can't remember what her maiden name was.
S-A-I-T-E-R.
It kind of reminds me of satire.
I think that's why I said, anyways, we'll probably never ever say her last name again, and I suck at names. I'm sorry, people. But I'll probably end up referring to her as Julie for the rest of this, because, you know, I like to come up with nicknames for everyone. So Herbie and Julie began dating and found they had a lot in common. Now, Joe, what do you think they had in common?
Macabre.
No.
Wanting... to have kids? I don't know.
It is actually something most people would not, like, would have thought of. So what they had in common was they shared very extreme conservative ideologies. They also shared the entrepreneur spirit, and they dreamt of one day owning their own business. So they had a lot of things in common and that they shared a lot of, but that's what pulled them together. So in 1971, not that long later, they married, and this is where things actually get a little odd. 6 months into their marriage, for whatever reason, and believe me, I searched up the yin yang, he was committed, his dad, Herb Sr., committed him to a mental institution where he stayed for 2 months. I could find nothing. And when I mean I could find nothing as to why they put him in there, they just put him in there, and I don't know why. They kept it really fucking hush-hush.
I was about to say, they probably kept it off the records like crazy. Yeah,
but he was there for 2 months. Him and Julie stayed married the entire time because she was utterly devoted and in love with her husband. Again, she's a conservative woman who always wants to stay by her husband's side and would never leave his side for whatever reason. But regardless of his odd behaviors and his oddities, she wanted everything, you know, to be there for him all the time. The positive thing about Herb, though, I will admit, is that everywhere I saw it, he had a strong work ethic. His first job was a copy boy at the Indianapolis Star newspaper. His job was running a news reporter's copy from one desk to another or any other small errors. So he was basically an errand boy. He was a low-level position, but Herb jumped into it like it was the best damn thing in the whole wide world. Like he was the biggest eager beaver ever. Each day he'd come to work dressed perfectly. Like, his shirts were ironed, everything was great. He was there for success. Everyone just thought he, you know, for someone who's an errand boy, he would dress better than some of the people that were working there. And he always presented himself better than a lot of people that were there. But like in high school and in uni, he tried to fit in with everyone. He was obsessed with fitting in with his coworkers and his bosses, much like in high school, but he never succeeded again. He was always trying to fit in, always trying to please everyone. Eventually being a nobody got to him and he left the position of the job for something better. He ended up working at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, also known as BMW, or as we call it today, the DMV. So,
he worked at the DMV?
Yeah. In Indianapolis, they call it the BMW, which is the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, but here in California, we call it the DMV.
Department of Motor Vehicles, yeah.
Yes. So, the usually proper and well-put-together Herb came into the BMV a completely different person, like the complete opposite. At his last job, he was overeager and would openly display his feelings if he was hurt or happy with being picked on. But at the BMW, he was the complete opposite. He was overly aggressive, bossy toward his coworkers, and would lash out at them for no reason. He was labeled as the oddball. His behavior was just erratic, and his sense of being proper was way out the window. One year into... This is my favorite part. Like, oh my god, when I read about this, I gagged. Like, I was just like, yes. So, one year, for his Christmas card, he sent to everyone, it was him and another man dressed in drag.
Nice.
That was his Christmas card to everyone.
I thought you were going to say, like, you put a dog turd in everyone's Christmas card or something like that.
We'll get there, but...
Does he actually put, like, a dog turd in somebody's Christmas card?
We'll get there. So, like I said, I'm sorry, but if someone had given this to me as their Christmas card, it would have been my favorite holiday card on my desk, front and center, and I didn't even care if I liked the guy or not. It would just be there, because that... Oh my god. But besides how I felt about it, we have to think this was back in the early 70s, all right? Few saw the humor. There was no humor in this car. People just saw this. They were morbid by it. They were just like, oh my god, what is this? So people started talking nonstop about him. People started to suspect that little Herbie was a closet homosexual and a nutcase. Well, we all know he was crazy, so that's nothing new. I don't know. I would have severely loved this card for myself. I don't know about you guys. Anyways, but he ended up working there for 10 years, and despite being a nutcase and an oddball, his coworkers all had one thing in common. He was a go-getter and he produced results. So he was, again, that strong work ethic came out from him. He was promoted to program director, but this was short-lived. In 1985, within a year of his promotion, he was terminated for urinating on a letter addressed to the governor. Remember, he urinated on his teacher's desk. So apparently to him,
he has an R. Kelly complex, basically.
I don't know. He's one of those people who are into urination, I'm assuming.
Golden showers.
Apparently, this wasn't the first time he had peed on something, might I add. Apparently, there was something that had gone around and...
So he's going around and marking his territory.
Yes! Pretty much. I've read so many places where sometimes they'd come into the building and they'd be like, what does it smell? And they'd be like, oh, maybe a dog was in here or something like that. But when he peed on this desk or peed on the letter and they fired him, they put two and two together. They're like, fuck, Herbie was peeing on everything while he was here. Yeah, so apparently he loves urinating on things. All right. So in his personal life, about 9 years into his marriage, Herb and Julie started a family. Marie was born in 1979, Yurik in 1981, Emily in 1984. Before Herb lost his job in the BMV, things seemed to were going pretty well, actually. Julie had quit her job to become a full-time mother, but had to return to work when her husband could not find steady work. Herb became a stay-at-home dad and actually was really fucking good at it. He was a caring and loving father to his children, but being jobless left him with way too much time on his hands. Kind of like what we have right now. But anyways, with way too much free time on his hands, he began drinking, and not just drinking like a little, but excessively, and he started hanging out at gay bars without Julie's knowing or his family knowing. So that's not us right now. I wish I could be at a gay bar right now. It's usually
the family that's the last to know.
Of course. Like, my husband will never be at a gay bar. Fool. If I was at a gay bar, Joe would probably be with me. Okay. Probably. So in September 1985, Herb was caught in a hit-and-run accident while drunk driving.
I thought... He was the one who got hit by a drunk driver.
Okay. He hit someone being drunk. His result, he got a slap on the hand.
Because he was a good guy?
Something like that. So they literally did nothing to him and just told him not to do it again.
What happened to the person who he hit?
No idea, actually. Never looked into that. I should have. Now that I think about it, maybe that was his first victim.
Oh my God.
But
that's what triggered it. That was a stressor.
Yeah, so they literally just told him, don't do it again. And he was just like, sure, I'll try not to. Because 6 months later, he was charged for stealing his friend's car and conspiracy to commit theft. But Lady Luck smiled at him, and those charges were pretty much dropped as if nothing happened as well. So again, they were just like, Herbie, please stop. And he was just like, I'll think about it. During the time he was job hopping, he managed to land a job working at a thrift store. At first, he hated the job and considered it beneath him. But when he saw that there was something big out of this, he jumped on it. Over the next 3 years, he threw himself 100% into what he saw as a major moneymaker, learning the business inside and out. Unfortunately, during this time, his father did die, but no one really knew if this had any impact on him because nothing changed. It was weird. So his dad died, and most people who are affected by, especially serial killers, like if there's like a death in the family, usually triggers something, but he didn't really seem affected by his father's death.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. It was just like a little side note. They're like, oh, by the way, his dad died, but he didn't do anything about it. I'm just like, what? Usually most people will be devastated if their parents die, but he was just like,
well, if you really consider the fact that his dad threw him into an insane asylum practically.
Well, kind of. I don't know what the relationship was. I tried looking up more on his relationship with him and his parents, but he was the eldest child, which tends to, I don't know, I guess parents might have high expectations for their eldest child, or I don't know. He just completely like over his head. He didn't really care that his dad died. And I was just like, I'm sorry, if my dad died, I would be lost. It's my dad, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so in 1988, little Herb borrowed $4,000. That's close to $9,000 in today's price from his mother. Herb and Julie opened a thrift store that they called Save-A-Lot. They stocked it with gently used clothing, furniture, and other used items. A percentage of the store's profit went to the Children's Bureau in Indianapolis. So they started donating to charity. It quickly grew in popularity, and business was good. Like, it was really good. In 1 year, they showed such a strong profit, they opened a second store. And within 3 years, they were no longer living paycheck by paycheck, but they were incredibly rich now. Like, whoosh. That's what you call the, American dream?
Yeah, pretty much.
In 1991, the Baumeisters moved into their dream home. It was an 18-acre horse ranch called Fox Hollow Farm in the upscale Westfield area outside of Indianapolis in Hamilton County, Indiana. It had all the bells and whistles. It was large, beautiful, and $1 million semi-mansion with riding stables and an indoor pool. It was Herb had gotten up in the ladder. He was a well-respected man in town now. He was a successful businessman, a family man who donated to charity all the time. But what seemed like the perfect family was starting to fall apart. Why is this? This is just, you know, the norm for anyone that goes to killing.
Yeah.
Like most family running businesses, there's a lot of stress. The stress came with the couple having to work together each day was starting to get to them both. From start of the business, Herb treated Julie like shit. He treated her just like a regular employee, but he would always yell at her and had higher expectations for her than he did the other employees. Julie didn't want to cause any stress or problems, so she usually stayed quiet, like a good little housewife. They took a toll on their marriage. Unknown to people on the outside, Julie and Herb argued all the time, and they actually split up several times, but would get back together.
Well, they were married. They had no other choice, right?
Right, and especially being a very conservative wife, you know, she's never going to leave her husband that way.
Yeah.
So on the outside, the family, I'm not going to even try saying their last name. I don't know why I'm struggling with it.
Just call them the B family.
The Bees. So on the outside, the family, everything looked great. The Save-A-Lot had a reputation for being overly clean and organized, but the mansion was quite different. The grounds had overgrown weeds. The house's outside appearance was starting to fall apart, much like the inside. Rooms were messy, and it was obvious to visitors that housekeeping was very low on the priority of the couple. The only area that had impeccable care was the pool house. Herb himself kept the wet bar stocked and filled the area with decor, including mannequins, and he dressed and placed around to give the appearance that a lavish pool party was going on all the time.
Because that doesn't set off any alarms or right, anything.
Like, that's not weird. And by the way, this was Herb's playground. No one was allowed in there besides him, and he took great care of this place. To offset and escape the craziness that is Herb, Julie would often take the children and stay with her mother-in-law in Lake Walwisi. Condominiums. So 99.9% of the time, Herb would stay behind to run the stores, or so he would tell his wife. So in 1994, Yurik, now 13 years of age, was playing in the wooded area behind the house when he found human skeletal remains that were partially buried. He quickly ran to his mother and returned, and in return, she called her husband Herbie. He claimed that it belonged to his father, as he was a doctor who would use skeletons for research. He found it in the garage and had taken it out back and buried it. But for some reason, Julie believed him. Now, why the living fuck does an anesthesiologist need a skeleton? Like, I love how they keep referring to him as a doctor when he's an anesthesiologist.
Well, you could still technically consider an anesthesiologist as a doctor.
It's like people who don't they're consider chiropractic. Well, they're specialists, but I like how people who are like, oh, I go see my doctor. They're a chiropractor, and they're like, chiropractor's not a doctor. And I think they are, but there's some people out there who think they don't. So anyways, as we all know, what goes up has to come down. So not long after the second store opened, business started to crash. Herb started to drink more, and now during the days, he would return to work completely drunk and act belligerently to his customers and his employees. The store went from being orderly to looking like the town dump. At night, instead of going home, Herb would cruise gay bars and return home and retreat to his pool house, where he would spend hours whimpering and crying like a child about his failing business. So Julie was starting to get worried. Herb was different and acting strange, and bills were piling up every day. Things were starting to go bad. While the family were busy trying to fix their failing business and marriage, a major investigation was underway in Indianapolis. A highly respected retired Marine County sheriff, now a private investigator named Virgil Vandegrift. I suck at last names, I really do. He specialized in missing persons cases. In 1994, Virgil was contacted by the mother of missing 28-year-old Alan Bustard. The last time she had last seen her son, he had mentioned he was headed out to meet his partner at a popular gay club called Brothers, and he never returned home. A little over a week later, Virgil gets another call from a distraught mother saying that her son was missing, and his name was Roger Goldlett, 32. He had gone missing when he left to go out one evening. He had headed to a gay bar in downtown Indianapolis, but never made it there by all accounts. Both victims had similar stories and shared similar lifestyles. They looked alike and were near the same age, but they seemed to disappear en route to the gay bar or at one place or another. Virgil made up missing people's posters and posted them around gay bars around the area. He was able to interview several family members and friends, and the only real clue was that Roger Goldlett was last seen willingly getting into a blue car with Iowa plates. Around the same time, a publisher of a popular gay magazine reported that Alan and Roger are not the first to go missing, and there's a large number of gay men disappearing in Indianapolis over the last few years. Virgil was now convinced that they had a serial killer on their hands and went straight to the Indianapolis Police Department with his suspicions. Insert raging and table flip now. Unfortunately, searching for disappearing gay men was the lowest priority. Helping an old lady cross the street or a cat from a tree was higher priority than this.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
At the time, if you were a homo, you were the lower than dirt. Police insisted that it was nothing and that gay people are unpredictable and untrustworthy and probably had moved out of the area without telling their family and friends to live their gay free life however they wanted to.
Wow.
Yes, those were their exact same words, might I add. Have we all calmed down now? Because I really haven't. Because when I was reading this, it really pissed me off. Anyway, so during the time the investigators had learned about an ongoing investigation in multiple murders of gay men in Iowa, these murders went all the way back to 1989 and would end in the mid-1990s with an unknown number of bodies found dumped along Interstate 70 and was dubbed the I-70 murders in the newspaper. Four of the victims had been from Indianapolis. So they had known about it, but they just didn't care.
Yeah.
Because, again, they're gay people. There was this individual who to this day wants to remain anonymous, but went by the codename of Tony Harris. He was certain that he had spent time with the person responsible for Roger and Alan's disappearance. He had also gone to the police and the FBI, but both times had been thrown to the side and ignored. So Virgil met up with Tony and heard the most disturbing story of his life. And this is what it was. According to Tony, while at a gay club, he noticed a man who seemed completely captivated by one of the missing person's pictures of Roger. He was just mesmerized by the poster, so much that Tony knew this man had something to do with his disappearance. So Tony wanted to learn more. He introduced himself to the man, and the man said his name was Brian Smart, and that he was a landscaper from Iowa. When Tony tried to bring up Roger, Brian Smart would become evasive and change the subject. Nothing seemed to work, and it came to surprise when Brian Smart invited Tony to join him for a swim at his house, where he said he was temporarily living. He said he was the gardener there and was doing landscaping for the new owner, who was out of town at the moment. Tony agreed and got Smart's Buick, which had Iowa license plate. Unfortunately, Tony was not familiar with the upper town of Indianapolis and this location, so he couldn't say for sure where the house was located. He was able to describe the area as having horse ranches and a large house. He also described a split rail fence and a sign that he remembered said farm, but he wasn't sure about anything else there. Tony remembered walking into the mansion-like house through the side door, and he remembered seeing the inside being a total mess. There were boxes everywhere and furniture all over the place. They walked briefly through the house until reaching the pool house that had a bar. They stepped up to the bar, and Smart started to make drinks for them. Right away, Tony got creeped out. All around the bar were mannequins set up as if they were at a party.
Yeah.
Smart had offered him drinks, but he was smart enough not to accept them. Because of this, Smart became talkative. He excused himself for a second. Tony suspected he had snorted cocaine, because when he came back, he was even more erratic and all over the place. So they eventually started talking, and they actually went for a swim. When they went for a swim, Smart brought up autoerotic asphyxiation and asked Tony to do this for him.
Yep.
So Tony went along and choked Smart with a hose while he masturbated. Smart then said it was Tony's turn. And again, Tony agreed. And as Smart began choking him, Tony knew he wasn't going to stop. Smart was choking him and Tony could feel himself fading. Tony then pretended to pass out and Smart released the hose. When Tony opened his eyes, Smart was visually shaken and was scared that Tony had passed out, he said. Tony always figured he would have been the next victim if he had not played his cards right. He didn't accept any of the drinks. He was also considerably larger than him, but I'm not sure how much, but it was enough for Smart to know that he couldn't manhandle him unless he was drunk or passed out. So in the end, Smart drove Tony back to Indianapolis, and they both agreed to meet again the following week. Virgil wanted to find out more about this Brian Smart, so Virgil arranged to be there when Smart and Tony were supposed to meet again, but Smart never appeared. He never showed up. So Virgil still believed Tony and took his story to the police. Mary Wilson, who was the main detective for the missing persons department, she took it seriously. Finally, someone from the police decided to take it personally. But no one else did, so this was like a one-woman show. She ended up taking Tony to the upscaler areas of Indianapolis in hope to regain his memory to see if he remembered everything. Unfortunately, he couldn't remember anything. But about a year later, Tony ended up meeting up with Smart again. He ended up seeing him at another bar. He ended up following him to his car and wrote down his license plates, and they ended up giving it to Mary. But when Mary ran the plates, it would surprise everyone with what they would find. The license plates came back to not a Brian Smart, but to a wealthy owner of Save-A-Lot, Herbert
Baumeister,
and Mary Wilson jumped down the rabbit hole that is Herb. Without a shadow of a doubt, she agreed with Virgil, and Tony had narrowly escaped to be the next victim of the serial killer. So, missing person detective Mary Wilson decided to attack this head on. She wasn't getting the information or the help she needed from homicide and other departments because, again, they were just gay people and no one cared about them. So Mary decided to do a direct approach and went to the store to confront Herb. I personally think this was a mistake. I think he was already messing up and, you know, not being smart about covering his footsteps. Mm-hmm. And if they had just stuck around and watched him, maybe they would have caught him in the act of doing this. But instead, she was a one-woman team, so I don't really blame her. No one in the police was caring. She had to do something. So I don't blame her. I blame the lack of caring the police, who were supposed to be there for the people regardless of their sexual orientation.
Yeah.
Anyways, she confronted him while at work at the store. She told him that he was a suspect in an investigation and several missing men. Mary requested that he allow investigators to search his home if he had nothing to hide. She didn't get the response she wished for. Herb refused and told her in the future she should go straight to his lawyer and to never come back to the store again.
Wow.
Yeah. Mary was at a loss. How was she going to get inside? She tried the only other person she could possibly reason with, Julie. Mary told Julie the same thing she had told her husband, hoping to get her to agree for a search the property. Julie, although shocked, was also firm and refused.
Yeah.
She tried Hamilton County officers to get a warrant, but they refused, stating that there was not enough evidence and it was Herb. It was Herb. He was a well-known man in the area who donated to charities. He was a business owner, a husband, and a beautiful wonderful father. There was no way he could be involved with gay men and of them disappearing or the murders on I-70 interstate. It was impossible, right? So fast forward 6 months. Herb is a mess. He seems to be emotionally and mentally breaking down. By June, Julie had finally reached her limits. They had stopped donating to charities as they had ran out of money. Their stores were falling and they were filing for bankruptcy. The fairy tale story was over and Julie was seeing a side of Herb that rocked her to the core, and thus her loyalty to her husband became rocky. She could not forget what Detective Mary Wilson said to her, and all she could remember was a skeleton her son had discovered 2 years earlier. Julie had had enough. She had plans to file for divorce and tell Detective Mary Wilson about the skeleton, and she was going to get them to search the property, and she did. Herb and her son, Yurik, were visiting Herb's mother at the time, and she knew there'd be no other time, so she called her lawyer. On June 24th, 1996, I was 6 years old at the time, Mary and three Hamilton County officers visited Fox Hollow Farm. Just behind the patio area where the children played every day, their eyes fell on what looked to be small rocks and petals all spread out across the backyard. The children played with these petals, and Mary knew better. She knew that they were human bone fragments, and in less than a day, the results came back from forensics stating that these were human bones. Now the police wanted to get involved, and the next day, police and firemen swarmed the property and began excavating. The bones were found everywhere, even on the neighbor's land. In a matter of days, 5,500 bones and teeth were found on the property. This was a graveyard, or also known as the boneyard. The search continued and was never ending. By the time the excavation was complete, there was an estimated that the bones were from at least 11 different men. Fortunately, only 6 victims could be properly identified. Those were Roger Allen Goblet, he was 34, Stephen Howell, 26, Richard Hamilton, 20, and Manuel Redsetters, 31. I'm sorry if I butchered their names. It wasn't until June 16th, 1999. Several years later, 3 years after police had found piles of human remains, DNA testing was able to identify 4 more victims on the ranch. And these there's 3 victims that have yet to be identified to this day. And those 4 new victims were Johnny Bear, 20, Alan Wayne Bussard, 28, Jeff Allen Jones, 31, and Michael Kieran, 46. When the police discovered the bone fragments, Julie grew worried. Her son, Yurik, was still with Herb, and the authorities had reason to be worried, as well as Herb and Julie were already in the process of getting a divorce. It was decided that before this hit the news that they had to serve Herb with custody papers demanding that Yurik be returned to Julie because they were afraid he was going to do something to him.
Oh, yeah.
Fortunately, when he was served with papers, he turned over without a fight. He was just like, take my son. I don't care. But so let's add salt to the wound, shall we? Julie was a free woman now, and she was tired of trying to hide everything from Herb. Not only did she allow them to search the house, but she also gathered evidence that linked Herb to the I-70 murders. Receipts provided by Julie showed that Herb had traveled along I-70 during the times that the bodies were found and dumped along the interstate. An eyewitness who had seen Herb leave a bar in 1983 with Michael Riley, who had later been found dead. Like other victims, Michael was strangled to death and deposited a nude or semi-nude in a river. What's even more damning, bodies had stopped appearing along the interstate at the same time Herb had moved into Fox Hollow Farm. So he didn't need the interstate anymore. He had 18 acres of land where he could bury bodies. So I believe this is what happened. He had a new and better area to dump the bodies and less of a chance of being caught. So Herbert was caught. His business over and his facade was gone. His wife was leaving him and taking his children, whom he loved. It was the end. Not long after Yurik had been released back to his mother, Herb disappeared. He had not returned home or to work or to his mother, nothing. A warrant for his arrest had been made public, and the news on the bones were being uncovered, were broadcast everywhere, and he just vanished. It wasn't until July 3rd, 1996, when he was found. More so, his body was discovered inside his car. It was a suicide. Herb had shot himself in the head while parked in Pioneer Park, Ontario, Canada. He wrote a 3-page letter suicide explaining his reasons for taking his life were due to his problems with his business and failing marriage. There was no mention of the murder victims. Herb had been linked to anywhere between 11 to 21 victims. Nothing had ever been confirmed as there was no trial or admission of such things. I think suicide is a silent admission to something other than a failed marriage and business, but that's just my personal opinion. Julie later stated that the relationship wasn't much of a relationship and just something to help hide who Herb really was. Julie said that they had been sexually intimate only 6 times over the 25 years of their marriage.
Wow.
With 3 times resulting in their children.
Wow.
Yes.
Could you imagine that? It's just like, okay, knock her up on just 6 times.
Oh, God. Yeah, it was weird. It stated, she stated he was hurting and he needed help. It was later determined in June 16th, 1999, DNA tests showed that Herb buried the bodies of the 11 men behind the house. So they had DNA proving that he was behind at least 11 people of the house. So that's why it's been confirmed, but again, he's still a suspect until proven guilty. Herb's story has been aired on TV from The Secret Life of a Serial Killer in 1997. What is most popular are the well-known shows that cover Fox Hollow Farm and the paranormal activity at this location. This is where I'm going to leave it to Joseph to go on about this. I can go on about it, but I'm going to let Joe cover this part of the paranormal. You guys have listened to me for long enough. So, Joe, take it away.
So, going on with the shows that you were mentioning, there have been quite a few, and including a book that was written by one of the current owners, of the estate. But anyway, there have been a number of different TV shows that have aired on television. The first one was actually a documentary / film called The Haunting of Fox Hollow Farm, which aired on October 21st, 2011. And then there was another one, Paranormal Witness, on September 26th, 2012, which was one that I remember seeing. It was actually pretty interesting. Another one, go figure, Ghost Adventures. Mm.
Those guys have
the bros. Yeah, those guys. That aired.
Zach, damn it.
Yeah. That aired on May 3rd, 2014. And the last one was Paranormal Encounters, May 24th, also 2014. So I guess it was like the thing to cover that area.
In 2014. I think it might have been like an anniversary of some kind, probably.
Probably, because it was like 96 when he killed himself, or was that 99?
96.
It was 96. Anyway, the book was written by a paranormal researcher named Richard Epps with one of the current or ex owners of the house, Robert Graves, who did experience a lot of the paranormal activity there. He and his family had, and one of his co-workers who lives on the estate also had a lot of paranormal activity occur during the time that they were there. And that, from what I saw, was published in 2019. The book was called The Horrors of Fox Hollow Farms, Unraveling the History and Hauntings of a Serial Killer's Home. Vicky and Robert Graves, they purchased the estate in the early 2000s and currently own 10 of the 18 acres of the original property, which they bought for a total sum of $987,000. You want to know how much the original price of the estate was?
I'm guessing over $1 million?
Yeah, it was. The original price was $2.8 million.
Holy shit. Yeah. So they got it for less than half.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy.
They almost bought it for nearly $2 million cheaper than what it was going on the market.
Yeah, they did.
While they were the owners of the house, or if they still are, I'm not too sure if they do this still, but back when he started experiencing a lot of this paranormal activity, he actually allowed paranormal researchers onto the property 5 times a year due to not only for their curiosity, but for the paranormal researchers' curiosity as well. The other owner, a man by the name of Noah Heron, is the other person who actually purchased the other eight acres of the property.
So they divided up the land by the acres.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And Noah Heron is also the owner of the Urban Vines Winery and Brewery. And he's also part of like a farmer's community also.
So did he build his brewery on top of that?
No, he didn't build the brewery on top of it, but he did have plans to build other things.
Oh dear.
So he's from Westfield and he purchased 8 acres of the land located on the property. And he actually plans on selling 3 lots and building a house for his own family. And even though he owns 8 acres, he is currently waiting for, or I'm not too sure if he's actually been granted the permission to actually build on it yet, but from what it sounds like, as he has. There are a few things about this guy that I kind of don't agree with. He's actually waiting for, or I guess he got the permission already, but while he was waiting, he had actually stated something that kind of irritated me. I was just like, really, dude? He was, Mr. Haran, who was aware of the murders and the hauntings, stated that the location and the land was too beautiful to pass up. He also added, I wanted to make a joke at the council meeting and say that we hope we don't find any bones while we're building, but I decided to keep it professional.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure if he would have said something like that, they probably would have denied him. Because that's like human remains and a lot of those people...
That's like desecrating human remains there. Do you not want the spirits to be happy?
Or yeah, like, are yeah. you trying to I piss mean, them did off? Did you not see...
Poltergeist?
Poltergeist. That's pretty much it for the current owners or ex-owners. Reported hauntings now, actually quite a few. As mentioned prior, Baumeister was suspected to have murdered anywhere between 11 to 16 people. All older males, anywhere from like mid to late 20s to mid 30s.
I think the oldest one was like 41.
Yeah. But yeah, the reason why I bring all that up with the bone fragments and everything, a lot of that human remains and not being properly disposed of or actually being buried properly.
Mm-hmm. Shown some sort of respect.
Yeah. It's bound to bring up a lot of angry spirits or just a lot of people with unfinished business and stuff like that being anchored to a place that pretty much kept them lost in an area. Okay, so some of the paranormal activity that has been reported include disembodied voices, unexplainable K2 meter readings. For those
What's
of you,
what's a K2 meter?
I was actually just about to tell you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Get there when I get there.
A K2 meter is a device made to pick up electrical fields. And the reason why paranormal researchers use this in their investigations is it's because it's believed that spirits can draw on energy from the surrounding area, which can cause the K2 meter to react erratically without any electrical pulses being located in the area. One thing about K2 meters, though, is that if you are walking through a home and you get too close to said electrical field, it'll actually cause a thing to react, and a lot of paranormal researchers who are new will take that as a ghost being in the area when they could just be nearby an electrical current or something like that. Ghost Ooh. Adventures, sorry. EVPs also have been found in the area, surrounding area, specific areas located primarily.
What's EVPs?
I was going to get to that too. So an EVP is actually an electronic voice phenomenon. In that case, it's...
Oh, when they talk to you?
Yeah, it can be
Every single time I see any kind of ghost show and they have like the voices, I love it when they put the subtitles there. Oh my god, did they just say death? And you're just like,
yeah. And one of the shows that I saw, like one of the quote EVPs that they found was just like a bunch of static, and they had like text of what was said. I'm just like, all I hear is text. That's all I hear.
You don't hear anything. And they're just like, oh my god, they just said this. And you're just like, what?
Yeah. Like the ones that are really... The EVPs that are really, I guess, convincing are the ones where it's like a single word or it's...
If it's more clear.
If it's a little bit clearer, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, electric voice phenomenons, that's what EVP
stands for. Well, one of them just come out and be like, penis. Would they say that? I mean, come on. And like, it's in his pool house, you know, they were there having fun. Penises played with each other. But it's like, what is one thing that you missed? Penis.
Oh my god.
Oh god.
Oh man. Anyway, in some cases there actually have been reports of full body apparitions, or I guess 3/4 full body apparitions.
Their knees up.
Yeah, basically from their knees up is visible. Anyway, one such case with the K2 meter, paranormal investigators experience erratic readings in the area known as the Burning Pit. Guess what Baumeister did there?
Wait, what?
Apparently there was a pit. I don't know if it was a legit burning pit, but apparently he had taken them to a specific location on the property to actually burn them, and apparently that's where he took the majority of his bodies.
I didn't know about this.
Yeah, so
everywhere that I researched didn't mention anything about a fire pit.
Yeah, not so much a fire pit, but it was the one location on the grounds where you would actually take them to, and I think it was somewhere off in the creek where you would take them and you would burn them. You would burn the bodies in the creek, and there are so many burned remains in there that people had actually dubbed that as a burning pit.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yeah, so when they were there, they obviously, if you're out in a creek with no known electrical devices, you wouldn't be getting any type of K2 reading unless there was some type of spirit or supernatural being in the area. It's in the middle of
nowhere, yeah.
In the middle of nowhere, and plus on 18, I think this was prior to the other,
the other owner.
Mr. Haran. The other owner, this was prior to him actually owning the remaining 8 acres of the land. And while they were there, they're noticing in one or two specific spots that they would continuously walk over, and there would be K2 readings where it would go from green all the way up to the red light, and they would sit there and wait.
That makes me wonder, because if the K2 readings were going crazy where the pit was at, do you think that some of the people, because they're guessing that a lot of these people died because of asphyxiation.
Yeah.
Because he would introduce his autoerotic asphyxiation thing. What if, like what Tony Harris was, he had passed out, but they didn't die? What if they didn't die until he burned them?
That's actually something to think about.
Right? Because in order to kill someone via suffocation, you have to be able to hold their throats down with the same amount of pressure for at least 3 minutes, sometimes more, or it could be less depending on the force and what's happening. What happens if he was holding them, they passed out, he thought they were dead, and he takes them to go get burned, and they end up burning alive? I mean, do you think
they could still be passed out or unconscious, but still have a heartbeat. But yeah, if you were to burn them while they're still...
Because that makes you think, if they died in the pool house, wouldn't their spirits be more haunting of the pool house than where the burn pits were at?
I'll get to that a little bit later.
Oh, snaps.
Okay, so going a little bit further, Joe LeBlanc, a friend and co-worker of Robert Graves, was in dire need of a place to stay, and that was a couple of months or about a year or so after they had moved in. Graves had offered the apartment located above the garage and told LeBlanc about the history of the property. LeBlanc found that the situation, he actually found the idea exciting of living in an area where people had died and knowing that there's paranormal activity going around. So he very willingly accepted and moved into the area above him.
Low key, everyone's gonna know this. I would love to do that myself, but not because people have died there. The way you made it sound, that I want to live there because people died there. No,
but because of the paranormal activity. See, I would be kind of in that same boat too.
I wouldn't be like, ooh, people died here. Ooh. But if I was
so you're giving me a discount, right?
Yeah, I know, right? But it's like, ooh, people died here. Ooh. But they're like, but there's a lot of paranormal. Ooh, please keep talking. Yeah. Like, I would be completely interested in the paranormal aspect and wanting to experience this, because I haven't experienced a lot in my life. But the fact that people died there, I don't want to be like, oh, so exciting. No. What's exciting is the paranormal part.
Yeah, definitely. LeBlanc found himself going with purchasing or going into the apartment and finding it exciting to actually move in. He actually moved in a month after he had gotten the okay from Robert Graves to actually move in. It didn't take long for him to experience any type of paranormal activity. How long do you think it took for him to move in?
An hour.
Actually, it was within the first day.
Oh, okay. So the first day.
But it's kind of difficult to... I was kind of like questioning whether or not I should add this, because I don't know if it could technically be considered paranormal. So on the first night, LeBlanc had a night terror about running away from an unknown entity through the nearby woods. He actually recalls that he could not see the entity, only that he could feel that he was in grave danger and needed to escape. It's pretty much that fight or flight response that he had, that he had while he was sleeping. And the reason why I call it a night terror is because he actually woke up, and the adrenaline that he had upon waking up, like, got him to jump out of bed and run straight towards the door. And when he actually got to the door, and this is actually kind of funny, he ran straight into the freaking door frame, and he didn't collapse, but like apparently he hit his head on the door frame and he fell down onto the floor, and he was trying to collect himself, and the more he realized that he was actually awake, he kind of like collected himself. But the thing that's kind of weird about this is that even though that he was able to completely wake himself up and compose himself, he still had the sensation that somebody was in the room with him, but he couldn't see anybody.
He just smashed his head into a door. I mean, I don't know.
I kind of laughed a little bit when I heard about that.
Yeah, I would have died laughing on that.
Yeah, but I mean, that's practically the tip of the iceberg with this guy. 1 week after living on the property, there was another evening when Joe had heard a knock at the door while he was eating dinner, thinking it was either Robert or Vicky Graves, the other owners, who actually told him that he could actually live at the place. He thought it was one of them or one of their kids knocking at the door, so he called out saying that he would be there in a moment, and the knocking grew louder and faster. Fred, Joe's dog, suddenly jumped up and stood where he was at, looking and growling threateningly towards the door. Joe, out of frustration, yelled out, "I said I'd be there. I said I'll be right there." When Joe got near the door, he claimed that he had a feeling, that same feeling, that something bad was on the other side of the door, and felt a chill run down his spine, as he explains. As he opened the door, he found that nobody was actually there. He looked out from the door to see if there was anybody at the bottom of the stairs, or at least trying to run down, but saw nothing. Confused, he closed the door, but the feeling that there was now something inside the room with him, he started getting that feeling that there was an entity with him.
Like he opened the door and let someone in.
Yeah. So the way this the apartment was set up is that it was above the garage, so you actually had to go up a flight of stairs to get to it. And apparently this also led to a portion into the house, which was on the opposite side of where the garage entry was at. So in order to keep private from the Graves family, or the Graves family and himself, he pretty much just used the entrance from the garage as his front door, and that's pretty much where he would always go. But yeah, like once he had opened the door, saw nobody there, he closed the door, but had this sensation that somebody was in the room watching him, and he actually stood in the room and looked in every corner and didn't find anything. He kind of tried to brush it off, and in order to try to get his mind off of it, he sat down, started watching TV, but the thing was is he kept getting that feeling that somebody was watching him. And while he was watching TV, he kept seeing some figure run from the corner of his eye, like next to the door, but it was always to that point where he couldn't completely discern what it was that he was seeing. So he kind of got a little bit of that feeling again that somebody was still watching him, and worried, he kind of got up, or not kind of, he sat up, walked toward the door, and as he was walking toward the door to get to the garage, the door flew open on its own. And there's actually a mark that the documentary that I saw, there's actually a mark on the door where the door had actually swung open and hit the other door.
Oh wow. So it was like a closet area.
So it left like a little indent or a paint chip on the other door that was like adjacent to it. From there we kind of move on to Robert Graves's wife, Vicky. One of her accounts of the activity on the property is one day she had returned from work. Robert was actually working on upkeeping the house. He was painting the house or something like that, and he was I guess making a lot of headway, so he wanted to show his wife what he had done. Also noticing that she was actually getting in, or like driving into the driveway, he went down to greet her and to show her what he was working on as far as the house went. When he noticed she had gotten out of the car and was like, she kept like double taking towards the woods area on the side of the house. Mm-hmm. And he noticed that she looked distracted by something in that area of the property. When he asked her what was wrong, she brushed it off and pretty much told him nothing. I didn't. Everything's fine.
Bullshit.
Yeah. Then there was a time a little bit later. Wouldn't be until a month later when she would actually see the same thing again at the edge of the side of the woods right before the house. And since she saw it a second time, she actually brought it up with her husband. But yeah, it wouldn't be until a month later when she would actually see what she saw again at the side of the thing.
I was about to ask, of the woods. You were just talking about the guy who's just staying there. And mm-hmm. Like, what about the family that lives there? Like, the graves, have they experienced stuff?
Yeah, yeah. The reason why I brought him up first was because, like, some of the stuff he experienced kind of coincides with what the family experiences, too. It's kind of like sort of saving the best for last kind of thing.
Sorry.
That's all right.
I'm always trying to jump to it.
It's okay. Anyway, she would eventually tell her husband what she had seen and what she describes as a young man in a red shirt walking at the edge of the tree line on the side of the house, seeming lost and then turning into the woods. And as he would actually turn and start walking into the woods, or the apparition or whatever it was that she was seeing, just as she was about to call out to the man to tell him that he was trespassing, the apparition faded before she could say anything. So this was in the middle of the day that this is happening. So it's not like you get within a certain area of the woods and you kind of just like lose sight of them because of the density of the woods. She could very clearly see the man fade as he was walking further into the woods midday.
And did she see like details of how he looks like, or was it just more of like an outline?
The only thing that she says she could see was that he was wearing blue jeans with a red shirt, but she couldn't really get any facial features because he was facing away from her.
Gotcha.
And it wouldn't be until a little bit later when she would recall that she didn't see the guy have any legs. The only thing that she could see was pretty much the thigh up, and everything else was just, it was just like completely faded.
Ain't got no legs.
But yeah, she had seen this not once but twice, and it wasn't until the second time that she decided to mention it to her husband. The thing is that Vicky was, she has a lot of scientific background as far as what she, I tried to find out what it was that she did, but apparently what she does for work has to do with a lot of science-y things, so.
She's a scientist.
Yeah, she was a scientist by trade, and so she would automatically try to justify a lot of the things that she was seeing as.
Like most.
Yeah, so she was trying to come up with any other reason other than paranormal. And it isn't until like a little bit later when she's like, yeah, something fishy is going on. To add to the creepiness, Robert had gone immediately into the woods to check if anybody was there to tell them to leave. However, when he actually went to go investigate, he didn't find anything. He didn't find footprints. He didn't find any sign that anybody was camping there.
He ain't got no legs. Find footprints if you ain't got no legs.
No, but still. Anyway, Vicky had a background in science, and with that in mind, she tried to do what she could to rationalize what it was that she had witnessed, which is why she didn't say it, which is why she didn't say anything.
Well, yeah, the first time around could be, oh, shame on me, and then the second mm-hmm. time around it's just like, well, nope, something's there.
Mm-hmm. Actually, a little bit later, going back to Joe LeBlanc, the one who actually lives above the garage, there was one evening where he was actually walking his dog. And while Fred. He was walking his dog, Fred, he saw the same apparition of the guy walking, the guy in the red shirt walking by the woods. And at first, he didn't know what was going on. So as he was getting closer, he was going to tell the guy that he was also trespassing. And then his dog, Fred started acting a little uneasy, and Frank actually got loose and started chasing the thing into the woods. And as Joe tried to catch up to him, he does eventually catch up to his dog, but it wasn't until that they were actually inside the woods at that point. And he recalls seeing a dark figure, roughly about 6 feet tall, like looking straight at him. And this was a little bit more towards the night, so he couldn't really see too much of anything else in the thing, but he did mention that there was a pretty large dark figure that was staring back at him while he was trying to get his dog, and he immediately picked up his dog and ran out of the woods. He didn't know what it was. He like looked back.
Did he have no legs?
He actually doesn't say. He says he actually had a photo of something. I guess he had actually gone back later. I don't know if it was the same time, but he did say that he did have sort of a photo-ish. And he showed it to some of the paranormal investigators, thank you, that he had the photo. He started showing them. And when I saw it, I was just like, it looks kind of sketch, but it wasn't there. Later on, Joe had actually brought that up with Robert and Vicky, and Vicky was able to confirm with him. She's like, yeah, I've seen that person like twice. And it's funny too, because Robert ended up asking if they were sure what they saw. If they were sure that that is what they saw, and Vicky was just like, she's like, I know what I saw. Damn. That's pretty much what she said.
Don't question your wife. Yeah. Don't piss her off. Remember, happy wife, happy life.
Happy wife, happy life.
Yes.
So another part that's actually quite notorious for having a lot of paranormal activity is the pool house.
Of course. Yeah. Save the best for last.
Yeah. So one of the things that started actually happening was one day when Vicky was vacuuming inside the pool house, her sons had actually brought in a lot of gravel, and they're like, oh, thanks, Mom, for cleaning up after us. You know, like little kids and whatnot. Anyway, she was vacuuming the debris that her sons had brought in when the vacuum actually stopped working, and she's trying to figure out what was going on with the vacuum cleaner. She flipped the switch on and off, and then she looked towards the plug, and she realized the plug was pulled out of the socket, and she was just like, that's weird. And so she went up, and she originally thought that she had exceeded the length of the cord and pulled it out herself. So she picks up the plug, puts it back into the socket, and continues, and it isn't long until the vacuum again stops working. And the first time it stopped working, she realized that the plug was lying pretty much right below the socket, as if she had actually pulled it. The second time it stopped, she turned around, noticed that it wasn't plugged in again, but she had noticed that that the plug was like several feet away from the socket. And the second time, she was trying to figure out what could have happened, and she realized that there was still plenty of enough slack on the cord for her to not pull it out. And so her thing is, since she wasn't able to figure out a scientific reason as to why the plug could have fallen out, she just shrugged it off and said, it just must be one of those things.
Scientists!
Yeah. So she picks it up, plugs it back in, and as she's walking back to the vacuum, she turns towards the plug and sees it being pulled by an unseeable force from the wall, and it just goes, the plug goes flying. And at that point, she's like, nope.
Scientist.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, there have been several EVP findings of that, too. There was actually...
What's EVP?
Electronic voice phenomenon.
Okay.
So a lot of paranormal researchers, they go there, they'll ask questions, and the reason why they use a recording device in order to pick up any extra voices that can be heard is because sometimes what can be heard on the recorders, we won't be able to hear ourselves because of the pitch or whatever. But it also helps that the electronic device helps give the entities enough energy for them to say something, which is why a lot of electronic devices either malfunction or the batteries die quickly, because they take the surrounding energy from whatever they can. And since we hold pocket-sized energy sources, that's what they go for. Some of them claim to have heard whispering inside the pool house with and without EVPs. They claim to have heard or have seen or like heard footsteps going into and out of like the storage area. One of the paranormal research teams that I actually saw was doing an investigation on the pool itself. They had submerged an underwater camera to catch the ripples to see if they could find images of any type of
I was just about to ask, I'm like, is there still water? They still have water in there?
They still had water in the pool. And they had actually there's actually one thing that Robert had experienced in there, and it was actually quite violent too. So one of the paranormal research teams had actually submerged an underwater camera to see if they could find anything, and they would actually purposely cause ripples on the pool to see if that would cause anything, to see if they can see any images or anything like that. But usually with these kind of things, I like, well, you can make shapes. You can make shapes out of anything that you find in the water, but the way that the water had actually rippled formed a definable face. Like, you could see a definable face within the ripples of the pool, which was actually, it was actually quite convincing, and it seemed to have actually moved, not so much move, but it would appear and then dissipate and then reappear. So it wasn't something that there's like, okay, maybe it was a one-time thing, but it was as if somebody was like sticking their face into the pool and pulling it out and putting it back in again. Someone's being dunked, forced in there. Yeah. It's believed that one of the things that Baumeister did was he used a hose to strangle some of his victims while they were inside the pool. One night when Robert was actually swimming by himself in the pool, he actually stopped in the middle of the pool and like looked around because he got the sensation that somebody was with him, but he couldn't see anybody, and he kind of shrugged it off. Also, like, honestly, if I'm in a pool and I feel like somebody's watching me, I'm getting the fuck out of there.
Right? Like, I'm already wary of water or anything of that kind. And
it wasn't long until he actually started swimming again that he felt what he says is like a sensation behind him, like as if somebody was swimming behind him. You know how you're swimming and you feel that, like, somebody like swimming behind you, get that push of water against you. He said he felt something like that, so he immediately stopped swimming to look around, and the next thing he knew was that he felt the sensation of somebody actually gripping his throat and squeezing his neck. Whoa. And he said that he actually struggled a little bit, but he struggled for maybe a couple of minutes, not a couple of minutes, but like I want to say a couple of seconds before it stopped, and he immediately got out of the pool and was just like, no, fuck that.
So my question is, so he knew people were killed or people died on that property.
Mm-hmm.
Did he know who it was specifically and the story behind
that? Well, the thing was, is that they didn't necessarily know exactly what was going on with the house when they purchased it. They just knew that they got the house for a really good deal.
So when did they purchase it?
It didn't give me an exact date of when it came in, of when they bought it. It just says they had purchased the house in the early 2000s, and that was probably, I want to say, maybe about 5 or 6 years after, I want to say maybe about 4 or 5 years after Baumeister had passed away. And you know how you said that he didn't do any like upkeep with the house or anything like that. That's pretty much what the Graves actually thought. They saw the house. They saw it as a fixer upper. So they probably thought that was the reason why it was so cheap. So
they don't know that it was the Fox Hollow Farm that was Herb that was there.
Yeah. So that was another reason why he decided to get this other paranormal researcher, Richard Estep. He was actually he's actually an author of another book, and I actually kind of forgot to get the other name of the book that he had actually published later, but he contacted this guy, told him about it, and together they wrote, and that's where they got the idea to write the book, The Horrors of Fox Hollow Farms. And that's pretty much his, I guess, tale of all of his experiences and stuff like that. And
I feel like it's another Amityville Horror one, though. Like, yeah, they probably upped it a lot more than it really was. But
probably, but still. I
gotta get those sales.
Make the property a lot more expensive. Going back to that other guy, Noah Heron, the other guy who purchased the other 8 acres. Apparently he was actually pretty excited about building on the land, because it was said earlier that a lot of people are actually trying to buy the land just simply because it has that history to it.
Wow.
Yeah. So one of the things that he said, aside from that snide remark about him saying that they hope they don't dig up any human remains or anything like that, was saying that, yeah, I'm pretty much going to be making a lot of money off of this, because a lot of people are looking at this land to purchase just to live on, because
of the history.
I've seen the estate and the surrounding woods and everything like that, and it is pretty nice. It's a nice area. He
sounds like a dick.
Oh yeah. Oh, that goes without saying.
He just sounds like he's just like, I'm gonna make profit off of people who died here because of the people who died here. I'm gonna make money off of it. Yeah. Like, it just sounds like he's this uncaring guy who's like, yeah, you died here. I can give a rat's ass. I just know I'm gonna make money off of your death.
Mm-hmm. As far as whether or not he's expanded on just the eight acres that he's had, I'm not quite sure. Like, a lot of the stuff that I was researching for this, majority of what I found was the accounts of Vicky and Robert Graves and Joe LeBlanc when he had actually started moving in. As far as the sons that of Robert and Vicky, as far as their sons, I actually didn't find anything that they had ever experienced. It was mostly from Robert and Vicky, who had actually seen and heard a lot of things. One of the other paranormal research crew almost didn't find anything the night that they were there.
Really?
Yeah, and it was actually the same one, the same paranormal group that was actually in the field by the burning pit that was getting the K2 reading. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they didn't catch too much stuff, but it wasn't until they were actually going back into the house and heading towards the foyer that they heard a man actually cough behind them, and they all looked. And everybody had said, like, yeah, no, that wasn't me. And they looked, and they're trying to find or see if there was anybody else on the in that general area that could like give off that kind of cough that loudly. And then as they were walking back into the living room, they saw like a shadow, kind of like a human figure, shadow of a human figure, kind of like briefly by one of the windows, and then it was just gone. So they went out to go try to investigate that, but they couldn't find anybody else on the property. One of the things that is pretty prominent is the paranormal activity of all the stuff that happens inside the pool room. And I'm not too sure on the accounts of the person with the red t-shirt and the no legs. But yeah, that's pretty much most of the paranormal activity that's experienced there. Yeah.
Well, I still want to go there.
I do too.
If you guys ever open that place up as an Airbnb just to stay a couple nights, I would so go there and stay there a couple nights. The same thing for the Lizzie Borden house.
Mm-hmm. That is a B&B.
It is. I know. I would definitely go there if I ever end up in that area, but not with the stay in place. I can't go anywhere right now.
Yeah, nobody is going anywhere with the stupid stay in place.
Well, it will end soon, I think. Well, thank you guys for listening. I hope you guys liked that tag team episode there.
It was really enjoyable.
Sorry if my portion was long. You know me, I like details way too much. Thank you guys. I'm glad we were able to get this second episode out. Stay tuned for the next one, which would come out the following week. We are going to go back to murder. We're doing another murder. So murder. As you guys notice, we are switching things up again. This is going to be a really primarily true crime podcast, with true crime followed either by a paranormal or a myth. So I will do my true crime as always, and then the next week Joe will pop in with a story of either a paranormal or a myth, and I will pop in also with a paranormal myth. This was just different because it involved murder, and I wanted to cover the murder part. So yeah, next week we'll jump into another murder. I hope you guys are looking forward to that one, or another true crime. It's not necessarily murder. I'm not going to tell you guys what it is, but it's not a murder. Could be. We don't know. So until next time, you guys stay safe, y'all.
Good night.
Bye.